Oh, I thought that one was
good. We're going to call the order, the Senate Committee on Education, on this amazing day of June 4th, which happens to be the birthday of Oksana's, our esteemed assistant over here.
Oh, congratulations.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
With that, we're going to go right to work fairly quickly, and then we're going to have a hearing after the work. We are going to open a work session on House Bill 2972A, and we'll have a short explanation by our administrator of the -7 amendments.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, House Bill 2972A requires public school students 7 years of age or younger who are beginning an educational program to have a dental screening. The -7s clarify the requirements for who may conduct a screening and require the dental director to establish guidelines for training screeners. They clarify that certification may be provided by a person who conducts a screening at a location unaffiliated with the education provider or someone who conducts regular screenings of the student. It also requires the dental director appointed by OHA to develop standardized information for distribution by education providers. They also add that ODE submit a summary of the reports to the dental director as well as the legislative committees.
And with those amendments, I think we, do we have our fiscal?
We do. It has a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
And I appreciate all the work that the people did to get this bill to where it is. In particular, our nurses that came forward from a couple school districts, all of them have worked together to get to where we are. So with that, Senator Canope.
Mr. Chair, yeah. Was Representative Hayden?
He was involved with it entirely. We have one issue, and when it goes over there, if they want to send it back, we took out the word nurse, but we said employee of the school district. They are the same. And so that made everybody, including when I checked with the people who wrote the amendments, does this include everybody? And they all agree that it includes the same people, but one person didn't want the name specifically there, the other one did, so that's what we did.
Chair Oban, I move the -7 amendments as presented.
Senator Canope moves the -7 amendments to House Bill 2972A as presented. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? Seeing none, they are adopted. Senator Canope.
Chair, when I move House Bill 2972A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Canope moves House Bill 2972A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? Senator Gelsey, did you wish to carry
sure.
this? Okay.
Did you pass an amendment for it?
Yes.
Which
amendment? We went with 7.
Fix it on the House.
Send it back to us.
You mean non-concur?
Yeah. It'd be fine. Our concern, and I will tell you this one.
Maybe she should come up to the dais.
Yeah, come on up and I'll invite you to talk. We'll leave it open. We haven't closed the work session, so we have taken the vote.
Okay. Did Representative Hayden come?
Nope.
Okay. I thought he was coming too. Okay. Thank you. Thank you for allowing me to squeeze in. I'm Representative Alyssa Kennegar from House District 46, parts of Southeast and Northeast Portland, and it's good to have you back, Senator Beyer. So Representative Hayden and I were the chief sponsors of this. We worked with a large work group. I, for many months preceding his coming into the building, and as soon as he came in, I was very excited to join forces with him, and we have been very eye-to-eye the entire time. The difference between the -6 and the -7 is simply around
nurse.
And it's permissive. And there are several states that allow nurses to do it. And I have a full report on that here. I can read you the states that allow it. And basically, this was permissive only. It doesn't mandate nurses at all. But it seems to me with a real dental workforce shortage that we should not be limiting. It's a best practice. Many places do it. It's not mandating that it has to be a nurse, but in many places they say it's a really important way to fill the need of a workforce shortage. There's a training that goes along with it, and it's a screening. It's not even an application of necessarily sealants, although that is sometimes done by nurses. But I understand there's been one nurse that has objected to it, but ONA is not in objection to it, and it's very limiting. I don't see a good reason to do it at all. So both Representative Hayden and I feel very strongly about it.
So from your perspective, the definition that says employee So doesn't include all the nurses?
Right.
Okay.
The problem with that is that school nurses are hired by either school districts or ESDs,
right.
But school-based health clinic nurses are normally not. And, in fact, some of those nurses are actually nurse practitioners. They're even a higher level. They are often hired by either the county health department or by FQHCs, for instance, Virginia Garcia. So it's really, really a shame for us to be knocking out a whole piece of the workforce that they may, and again, this is in conjunction with, you know, the Oregon Health, it's a collaboration between Department of Health and Oregon Health Authority dental director. So it's not like, you know, they will make a good best practice decision,
so,
but it's very limiting to take out.
My only question to that is, we have in this deal a trained in accordance with the guidance established by the dental director.
Correct.
If they are trained that way, they can do it.
Right, exactly. They would say, you know, what kind of
the
training.
The bill allows that. So a nurse who meets the requirements of trained by the dental director would be available. So would anybody else that walked in the door who was trained by a training by the director.
Well, if it's on the record as interpreted that way, then that would be acceptable.
When we talked to the people who were writing it, that was their interpretation, and that's why we put dental director in, because if they're going to come in and do it, they're going to have some training anyway, and if that training has been prescribed by the dental director, it is available to anyone.
I appreciate that. With that being on the record, I would actually be fine with that.
Okay. Thank you. That's what we worked hard at getting that.
I missed that last piece, and thank you for that clarification. I do think it's really important that we be permissive and
we agree.
Have as big a workforce as possible to tackle this very important issue.
You and I both agree, and
thank
I
you.
Think this opens up to a much larger group.
Yeah.
Because it can be, you know, if you have volunteer parents who go through the training,
yep.
And they're looking for the thing that they've asked them for, they can be available to work with this.
That's fabulous, and I really am happy not to do another non-concurrence because you probably know I just did the first one on a dental bill, and I don't want to develop a bad reputation. I do hope whoever carries it might mention that on the floor.
I would be happy to
Great.
Do so.
Thank you so
Thank
much.
Thank you. That was our whole intent, was to get as big a group as we could get.
That's fantastic. I love that. I really appreciate the opportunity
okay.
to testify.
Thank you. Thank you. With that, we will close our hearing on 2972A. And we're going to open a work session on 3319A. And we'll have a short explanation and decide if we need to have anybody even talk, because we are moving quickly.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, House Bill 3319A directs school districts to submit a report to the Department of Education on strategies and activities used to reduce dropout rates. This bill was voted out of the House Committee on Education 5-4. The bill has no prior subsequent referral. We are considering the -2 amendments at this time. The -2s requires ODE to produce a report on best practices, but clarify that school districts may respond to ODE's request for information on a voluntary basis. A minimal fiscal impact was issued for the bill with the -2s, and the -2s have no revenue impact.
So again, it changes the context in that a voluntary request to get best practices, and then the department will work on some stuff after that. I've talked with the people who were opposed before. They are all okay, and you can see some heads shocking. So, Senator Knope.
Chair Roblin, I move to adopt the -2 amendments as presented.
Senator Knope moves to adopt the -2 amendments as presented. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? They are adopted. Senator Knope.
Chair Roblin, I move House Bill 3319A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Knope moves House Bill 3319A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
And Mr. Chair, this
yes.
does legalize flavored tobacco, correct?
Completely. is there any opposition now?
You better respond
Still
seeing,
to that. I will respond to say that it does not, but I'm sorry.
All right.
Sorry for you.
I was just checking.
Senator Knope. Sorry. Is there any...
Well, we could do that amendment real quick. Conceptually, it'd be fine. So.
Mr. Yes. Chair, I just wanted to thank Representative Taylor, who has worked tirelessly on getting this bill to a forum that it can pass. I appreciate that hard work, and especially the dedication to looking at how we can get more kids graduated from high school. I think that's something we all share is wanting to reduce the dropout rate, increase the graduation rate. So thank you.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Any opposition to the bill as amended? Seeing none, it is approved. And so we will close our work session on 3319A.
Is need it a carrier.
Oh, we need a carrier. 3319. I would be glad to carry it.
It's the last bill out of the committee, you should.
Yeah, there we go. And now, just so people know, there are a lot of people who have other commitments. We have other meetings that are starting, transportation meetings,
yes,
and other things that they have scrouted over on us. So we have almost everyone leaving except me. However, and now it looks like only me.
Interesting. You have Gretchen. So.
And I have Gretchen. So I have made a commitment that I wanted to get some things on the record, and a group of people have come to do that, which I appreciate. Because as I planned my schedule for the interim, there were a few issues that came up that were really important. And I want to get some information now so I can decide if there's things that we have to work on longer or not. The first group of, and next week we're going to do one on OEIB. Today it's on chronic illness. And in this particular case, we had, I think, three different bills that came up over time. One was on adrenal insufficiency. Another one was on, I think we talked about diabetes. Another was a dyslexic bill, not the same kind of thing. But there are, in many of those cases, medications that are delivered at school. And there are protocols that are necessary for the kids to be safe in that environment. And when we start getting bills that describe each one, it makes it difficult. And I would like to see if there's a way in which school districts and schools can come up with procedural things that allow them to adjust for these things and to identify which ones are the most serious and whether they need an actual nurse or a doctor or where other ones need a person trained who can be trained to be there at the same time. What are the parameters that are available? I know we have 504 plans. I know we have other kinds of things that can address this. But obviously it's not working for a few of these people with special needs, and I would love to figure out how best to handle that, and maybe if we need a work group to come up with a procedural thing. So that's why we're having this informational meeting on student of medical emergencies. So I'll open that if I haven't already and call up Mitch Kruska. Thank you, Mitch. I knew that too. And Sarah Drinkwater. We're from the Department of Education. We passed your bill for your nurse. Proceed. Thank you for coming back. Yeah. So the rest of the people had to have other meetings.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin and Senator Haas. I'm Sarah Drinkwater, Assistant Superintendent at Oregon Department of Education with the Student Services Unit. And I'm here today to talk about Oregon School Nursing Presentation.
And I am Mitch Kruska, Director of Educational Programs with the Oregon Department of Education.
To give a little background, I thought it might be helpful to give some information about who school nurses are and what school nurses do. So school nurses are registered nurses. They also are certified by TSPC and coordinate health services that are in schools. They provide health services for all students. So that means anyone who is enrolled. You don't have to have a special health care plan in order to be able to access services. They also provide special services for students with disabilities who might have a very specific medical plan as part of their IEP. And they also have a very important role in interpreting health care plans, information from physicians or other outside medical providers that might be related to a student's 504 plan, Section 504 plan, or IEP. They also specifically develop, I mentioned before, individual health care plans, and they develop these plans specifically under their license.
Do you want to advance this?
Oh, yes. Thank you.
You want me to do that?
No, I'm good. Just
okay.
Remind
right.
me.
Yep, I will.
And they do develop the health care plan under their State Nurse Practice Act. This is one particular responsibility that is not able to be delegated to other non-medical licensed people. They may provide health evaluations and services in preparation for an IEP as part of an evaluation plan or for students that have a 504 accommodation plan. These students tend to be more medically fragile or have medically complex cases. They may respond to crisis interventions that happen in school. As we know, there are emergencies happen. Students fall ill. They fall off of playground equipment and other things that might happen. Because they are school district employees, they work under FERPA, which is the Family Education Rights and Privacy Act. To give a little bit of information about school-based health centers, these centers provide different kinds of medical support for communities and students in schools. They are public health primary care centers that are located in school buildings or on school property. They're similar to a healthcare clinic that you might find in your own community. They are bound by HIPAA, the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, and they are typically staffed and operated by community healthcare agencies, a healthcare department, or a local clinic. And the school-based health centers provide services by appointment. They may do routine medical clinical services, prescriptions, immunizations, well, child checks, sports physicals, those kinds of things. And they may do health screenings, age-appropriate, other kinds of consultation. This slide sort of puts side by side the information that I just provided between school nurses and school-based health centers. Some things to note at the bottom. The school nurses work under a student's primary doctor's requirements or specific health care services that must be provided. Medicaid could be a first payer if a student is eligible for Medicaid services, and school nurses work under FERPA. School-based health centers can access private insurance and also look at Medicaid as a second payer.
So do we require every school district to have a nurse?
Every school district to have a nurse. There are nurses that may be provided if a school district is very small that would be provided from an ESD, but a district would have access to a school nurse.
Okay. Perfect. Yes.
School nurse report. Last fall, the legislature was provided the school nurse report for 2013-14. And in the schools that provided data from 2013-14, the average ratio of nurses to students was one nurse to 2,119 students.
Seems like a reasonable case for us.
Oregon law recommends, Oregon law provides some recommendations related to nurse student ratios. And I'm going to put these out there so that we can see them all at once. There are three different categories that we use in Oregon to talk about students who have more intense needs: medically complex students, medically fragile students, and nursing dependent students. I'll start with the nursing dependent students. That would be a one-to-one relationship because the student may have a breathing tube and have to be suctioned regularly throughout the day in order to be able to continue breathing. Medically fragile students are those that have a life-threatening condition and require immediate assistance. There may be a newly diagnosed six-year-old with diabetes that has not come under control, and a nurse would need to be able to provide medical care, perhaps give insulin because the six-year-old may not even be able to know how to understand some of the things that are going on and how they're feeling. Medically complex students may have an unstable health condition and just need daily support. It might be a student with epilepsy that is being treated with some seizure medication, but things may still occur. They're still unstable, but don't need as much intensive care throughout the school day. So the Oregon law recommends that for medically complex students, the ratio be one nurse to 225. Medically fragile students, 1 to 125, and then the nursing dependent students, of course, need the 1 to 1 support. It's encouraged that the ratio between nurses and enrolled students is 1 to 750 students. As I mentioned above, the average ratio was 1 to 2,119. This is a table that came out of the school nurses report and shares the numbers related to the medically complex students, medically fragile students, and the nursing dependent students over the last three school years. I think to take note in the medically complex students, which is the column to the left, there was a great increase between 2011-12 and 12-13, and then a slight decrease in 13-14. There was a lot of work done between 11-12 and 12-13 to understand the definition of medically complex students. And so that's why there was a larger increase there. The number of medically fragile students has sort of gone up and down a little bit over 3,000 in 2011, dipped back down and back up. Again, I think some of the definitions as we work with districts in compiling the information. And then there has been a increase, just a steady increase of students who need one-to-one service from 89 in 2011-12 to 148 this past school year, 13-14. I provided the definition a little bit earlier on about who are medically complex students, and so that is the definition that is in the school nurse report. So again, that this type of student may have epilepsy but might be having a seizure, and a nurse could recognize what those seizure characteristics are and perhaps provide some support.
On that previous page, are all of those people covered either by an IEP or a 504, would you expect, or not?
They may not be. There's probably a majority of them that are, but some could be on a health care plan individually. It depends on what kind of other accommodations they might need with the plan.
Thank you.
Did you want to say?
Well, I was just going to say it. Oftentimes, those students, it'll depend on the impact that it's having on their educational performance as well. Drive an evaluation for special education that these issues might rise. So there's a possibility that there are or they're not. Yeah.
This is the definition for medically fragile students. As I mentioned before, this might be a newly diagnosed young diabetic student who is not able to developmentally sort of care for themselves as they learn all about their diabetic condition and when certain steps need to be taken in their care. As a student ages, they learn to take care and monitor their own diabetic situation, but not when they're young. And then nursing dependent, I gave the example of a breathing tube, and those students are often suctioned multiple times during the day in order to keep the airway open. So some information about the state of nursing in Oregon. We rate 48 out of 51 for our nurse student ratio. As I mentioned earlier, the average was 1 to 2,119. That was in 13-14. The range, though, was from 1 to 1,500 students and 1 to 5,000 students. So that's the outside low range and high range of our ratio, and then where the average sits right in the middle. There has been an increase, I think you see from the tables, of students presenting with complex and ongoing medical issues. And at the same time, the funding has not been able to keep up with the need. And school health services, and there's been a reduction, I think, in the number of school nurses. The ratio speaks to that. School nurses have reported increased needs of students in these areas. Obesity and some of the related difficulties that come with obesity, chronic disease, diabetes, high blood pressure, those kinds of things. An increase in asthma, food allergies is very high. Vision difficulties, mental health and emotional health issues, stress-related illnesses, issues related to just accessing health care, and some of the sexual health teen pregnancy issues. This is a little bit of information about school nurse delegation, and it appears that nurse delegation to non-medical school staff has kind of become a norm. In districts with high nurse-to-student ratios, nurses are not often available even when a crisis occurs. They're not on site, they're somewhere else. And some of the delegated responsibilities fall to insulin dosing and injection, providing medication for anti-seizure medication that is administered rectally, doing urinary catheterization, and then crisis response in medical emergencies where it might be necessary to make a medical judgment and the person making the judgment isn't a medical person. School nurse funding is through our state school fund, and most nurses across the state are paid on the same certified salary schedule as teachers. For students who are eligible, Medicaid can be accessed as a payer for school health services, and that match is 60-40 with a 40% school district match.
So this is where I come in. I was handed the responsibility for this program about 6 months ago when we hired a school health specialist, ed specialist at the department. In the last 6 months, the ed specialist and I have been doing a thorough review of the program and the school health, especially school nursing circumstances. And as a result of the review, we've come to some suggestions around recommendations and some plans that we are taking into account to move forward. A lot of the work that we've done is been around actually going out into the field. We've been all over the state now shadowing school nurses and kind of watching what it is they're doing during the day, and getting a lot of the information that was provided in this presentation came directly from those school nurses. We also attended here recently, about a month ago, the Oregon School Nurses Association annual conference, and had an opportunity to sit down and talk to school nurses directly about what they're experiencing on a day-to-day basis in the educational field. As a result of that, these are a couple of the things that have come out of that. First of all, we have Senate Bill 698, which is establishing the School Nurse Task Force and to look into funding for school nursing. And that is one that we welcome and will certainly take advantage of. With the recent changes in the Medicaid billing and the Medicaid funding for what were referred to prior as free school services that we were unable to bill for, school districts were unable to bill for, the federal government is now under Medicaid has now changed the rules and now are allowing school districts to bill for that information. So under that, we are looking at coming up with some plans and some assistance to the field around how to take advantage of that, those changes. And the School Nurse Task Force will certainly help to bring the players together to help do that. We plan to make a request for an additional FTE of education specialist. This person will focus on school health services and support, and working with the field and school nurses around how can we address and resolve some of these issues. We currently are working on a cross-agency partnership with Oregon Health Authority, to train and support school districts around Medicaid funding. The primary Medicaid funding expert in the state really is housed within OHA, because that's their primary responsibility and they deal with it a lot. So we've been working very closely with that individual to come up with a profile and plan that can be used by educators to begin to take advantage of the Medicaid billing that's available for school nursing services.
So with that, say it's a 60-40 match. Can you use the salary you're paying the nurse as part of your match?
Yes, and the nurse services that you're billing for can be used to pay for that school nursing position or additional school nursing positions.
Okay, so that's our hope. The funding that comes in from the federal government can be used in those. Does it have to be used in those areas?
It does not.
So that's sometimes harder because you can get the money and use it someplace else. Okay, I just wanted to make sure I understood that.
I would guess, I would think that potentially I'm not aware of, at this point in time, Senator Roebling, that there is a requirement that because the district's required to put the money out front and then they get reimbursed from Medicaid. So I don't know if there's any restrictions around whether or not they have to use the money from Medicaid for a medical purpose since gotcha. They're receiving reimbursement. And it could be general fund dollars that they spent originally right. for the medical services. But that's a very good question, and that is one that I certainly will ask when we okay. do have our task force. And finally, we, through a lot of consultation with school nurses and issues around connection between the state and the field are looking at establishing a school health policy steering committee. And you can see that that steering committee will be made up of school nurses and other school health stakeholders and will assist ODE in our policy making and also in moving forward around trying to address the issues that we face with school nursing and, again, coming up with policies and procedures to assure that if you are receiving Medicaid reimbursement, is there a way to make sure that that money goes back into additional school nursing services, which are desperately needed in the field? So those are the suggestions that we have at this point and some of the things we're going to do as a department to move forward and try and address these issues.
So thank okay. you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Not a lot of us to look for, but I appreciate it, and I appreciate having that material so that I can go back and look again later as to what our requirements are. So we have recommendations, no requirements on the number of nurses, obviously, because we have not got quite close to it since the right. lowest number. The yep. best we have is twice as much as the recommendation.
Correct.
Right? Okay.
Mr. Chair, yeah. Just to clarify the question you asked, school district, there are no requirements to have a school nurse. Just
the re- Chair Roblin, Senator Haas, the requirement would reside in the health care plan and what services a particular student would need. So in terms of a building having a school nurse in and of itself, there isn't a requirement. But if there is a student inside of the school that needs one-to-one dependent, has a breathing tube, a school nurse or a nurse needs to provide that service. But in terms of a requirement somewhere from the federal government that a school have a nurse on site, it's not worded that way.
Follow up, sir. Yeah. If I could, then okay, aside from those kind of ADA kind of, if you don't have that population, just general population, are there any requirements?
No, it would still fall to a plan that a particular student has and what is in the plan and who is required to provide whatever the type of service that is. Yes.
And so I would say that most districts have some of the, not the most fragile, 80-some of those. So there's 197 districts, so there's a whole lot more schools. But when it comes to some of those other populations that get up into the thousands, most school districts have somebody who meets one of those other conditions.
Right.
And for them, even though the nurse doesn't have to be there, the nurse has to write the plan. So
correct.
Whether it's at the ESD or at the local school district, there has to be a nurse involved in making the plan. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. So.
And the yeah. delegatable services that might be provided by an unlicensed come under the responsibility of a nurse's license. Then okay. that nurse is held accountable. Right.
Senator Roblin, Senator Haas, to answer your question specifically, there is no law that requires that a school district have a school nurse. So there's no state law or federal law that says every school district must have a school nurse.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So next we're going to bring up Tricia Smith, Maureen Heineman, and Nina Karras. Hope I got this close. Thanks for being here. And whoever wants to start.
I can start.
Okay.
Chair Roblin and Senator Haas, my name's Maureen Heineman. I am from the Oregon School-Based Health Alliance. We're a membership organization that represents school-based health centers around the state of Oregon. We believe that school-based healthcare keeps kids healthy, learning, and thriving, and so we're really pleased that you're having this hearing today. And the increasing recognition really around the state and through the legislature of the importance of health to educational success. Some examples from studies about school-based health centers is that students in states with SBHCs as Medicaid providers have higher academic success than those in states without SBHCs as Medicaid providers. And another study showed that that after receiving school-based health center mental health services, students had a 50% decrease in absenteeism and a 25% decrease in tardiness. So the first SBHC opened in 1986. There are currently 72 SBHCs around the state in 21 counties. There are four more that are in the planning stages, which will take it to 24 counties. 42 of those are in high schools, 11 are in elementary schools, 6 are in middle schools, and 13 are in combined grades. And in 2000, the Public Health Division established certification standards that are tied to funding. And in 2013, those were actually put into statute. And so I've provided you with a packet, and it has the certification standards in it, so you can reference those in later conversations if need be. As Representative Kenny Geyer mentioned, SBHCs have medical sponsors, and those sponsors are responsible for providing funding, staffing, medical oversight, providing a medical director, billing support, ownership of medical records, and then they have written agreements with the local public health authority through which the state funding flows, and then the school district as well. So the sponsorship is around, we just opened a couple centers, so this is slightly off, but around 72% of SBHCs that are sponsored by federally qualified health centers, 57% sponsored by local public health authorities. Some of those are also FQHCs, so there's some overlap. And then 49% of those are recognized as patient-centered primary care homes, so they can work more closely with their CCOs. Other kinds of sponsors can be private providers, hospitals, and rural health clinics as well. So the minimum staffing is typically a nurse practitioner or physician's assistant along with an office assistant. And then some of them also have a pediatrician, medical assistant, nurse, increasingly a dental hygienist, and then qualified mental health providers. So last year, 57 SBHCs had a mental health provider. I think that's increased because there was a legislative investment in mental health services that has gone through addictions and mental health through to SBHCs, and which we've seen an incredible impact from. They are open a minimum of 3 days a week, the certified centers are. There has to be at least one licensed medical professional on site each day with two people there at all times. And they are required to provide both walk-in and scheduled appointments. So the certification standards, they're based on best practices as well as state and federal laws and regulations. And so they set forth the minimum staffing policy and services requirements. And so beyond the minimum requirements, the services and policies are determined locally by the school board. And so they vary across the state. But the services listed on the slide are typical services that are provided. They're primary care oriented, like well child exams, the sick visits, reproductive health, and then there's mental health. They also can do classroom presentations, and many of them have also youth activities that they do, like youth advisory councils, and that do activities in the schools like anti-bullying campaigns or suicide prevention or something. So in the 2013-2014 school year, 32% of clients had an adolescent well visit. 26% of visits were related to mental health. I expect to see this year's data show an increase in that because of the investment. And then 13% of visits had immunizations administered. So as far as the emergency services, the schools and the SBHCs determine locally who within the school is a first responder, and it is generally not the school-based health center, just because they may not be open all the time. They may have a clinic full of students, and although they're on school grounds, they may not actually be in the school. It depends on the site, and so it's determined locally, but generally it's better to have school personnel that are trained in first response and then their own policies. The benefits are many, but it's, you know, in sum, it's that kids have access to health care when and where they need it, regardless of cost. And this leads to decreased absences and the ability to learn, leading to more success in school and improved health outcomes. So school-based health centers are really a continuum of health services within the school and also as part of the broader health system in Oregon. So we, like school nurses, operate, you know, we like to say we operate at the intersection of health and education. And so we, along with 35 plus other organizations in the Healthy Kids Learn Better Coalition, have long advocated for coordination between the Oregon Department of Ed and the Oregon Health Authority. So I'm really pleased to see the recommendations that they've put forward. We have seen that the Early Learning Council has established coordination very nicely through dedicated support at the state level and then resources at a local level. And so we're seeing those early childhood providers coordinating with CCOs and other health entities at a local level and would really like to see a similar investment made in the K through 12 level. So, and then as part of the Alliance for Kids, we're also developing forums that focus on absenteeism regionally as a way to bring this issue of an idea of coordination to light. So I wanted to add that and offer any information that you might need in addition.
So some of the school-based health clinics are run by a other health clinic. So mm-hmm. they aren't school employees.
That's correct.
Correct? Okay.
That's correct. So they are run by a medical facility of some kind, and so they operate under HIPAA confidentiality standards.
Okay. Mm-hmm. That makes it more than evident that you can't use them for that first responder role because they really aren't school personnel. They would be there if needed, and
correct.
If they happen to be walking along, they would do it because that's part of their training. But in general, the school calling up and say, I have this problem, would take away from the clinic working as a clinic, taking care of kids because you have enough emergencies happening that all of a sudden you don't have the personnel you need to keep your schedules.
That's right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes we put in a clinic goes in, and then the school thinks they don't have to have the responsibility necessarily for the nurse, and all of a sudden certain things that were happening at school aren't happening. Other things are better. I mean, I think sometimes mm-hmm. the wellness checks, the other kinds of things, the opportunity for a student to get a physical even for an activity, which they couldn't do before, all of a sudden some of those things happen, which makes the school work better, but it isn't the answer for the entire issue at the school. I just wanted to get that on the record.
Yeah, so. Chair Roblin, I appreciate that comment, and I think that we all agree that school-based health centers and school nurses ideally will work along this continuum, and that will bring an amazing array of health services to kids if we're able to do that. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks.
Whoever's next.
Go ahead. Okay.
Senator Roblin, Senator Haas, my name is Nina Fakaris. I'm a school nurse, and I'll do this very quickly. So the two reasons I'm here, one is to answer some of the questions that were presented to us, and two, to ask your support for the Senate Bill 689, which is my plug for that. So I've been a school nurse for 27 years. I have been active in our state Oregon School Nurses Association, It is the only professional organization in the state that provides professional educational guidance to school nurses. We are affiliated with the National Association of School Nurses, which is our professional arm, which provides best practice guidelines, scope of practice, nurse ethics, all those kinds of things that school nurses really need to rely upon when we practice. So if any of us are brought before the State Board of Nursing or sued, the first thing they ask us is, you know, well, where have you gotten your continuing education and are you a part of your professional organization? And that's the entities that I've been very active in. I was honored in 2008-2009 to be selected Oregon School Nurse of the Year. And then in 2009-2010, I was selected as the National School Nurse of the Year. So in my professional practice, I had to give back. So this year I decided that I would run for national office against a nurse from Connecticut, and in May found out that I was elected president-elect of the National Association of School Nurses. So in June I'll go back and swear my oath of duty and then do president-elect for 2 years and then serve as the president of our National Association for 2 years. So my passion in school nursing runs deep. So to answer your first question, what kinds of kids do we see in school today? So you have a copy of my testimony, and on page 2, there's a large table. So our electronic student information system allows us to gather this kind of data. These are the medical categories with which we can gather data. So these are my 3 schools. I have a 4th program that has about 100 students in it, but it compiles kids from all of our 5 major comprehensive high schools, and so it's too hard for me to get that data. So I just did the 3 that's easy for me to collect. So those are my total number of students. Our 4 biggies that are the most prominent in schools that we work with every day.
Quick question.
Yes.
So how many nurses in your district?
We have 12.
Okay, so you are we are
one of the big ones. We also have 40,000 kids in our district.
So
but
is the 3,688
those are mine.
Those are your kids.
Those are my kids.
Okay. And these are ones that have these issues. There would be other kids who you would have under the total enrollment of
absolutely
these schools, right?
Absolutely.
So
the
you
total
don't quite
enrollment
make the 750 or the other number.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. So the medical conditions that most school nurses run into every day, we're impacted by asthma, which is one of the leading causes of accidental death among our kids, behind a couple others. Anaphylaxis, which is life-threatening allergies, and it can be to almost anything, but the ones at school primarily are food-based, bee stings, and latex. While children can be life-threatening allergic to medications, you can see in our system we're able to pull those kids out because we're not going to give medications at school that parents don't provide. So we don't, you know, we understand that that's not built into our statistics. Diabetes obviously is another huge impact for school nurses, and seizures. So of those children, the number of health management plans that I write, individual plans on children this school year, has been 234. That's my, if you subtract out my anaphylaxis, my diabetes, and my seizures, I have about 63 other plans that I've written for children with other medical diagnoses. The one that came to mind that I thought I would share, since this is an education committee, is I have a student that I've worked with for several years that I realized I needed to write a plan for when he came to me one day and he said, here's my math quiz, because we've kind of been watching how he's doing, and it was blank, totally blank. So I shared with him what happened here, and he said, I didn't have a pencil. So I go to the teacher and I say, oh, pencil? She said, oh yeah, there's a jar of pencils right here on my desk. He sits right here. He has access to a pencil. Well, my student has a disease where a part of his brain that connects the two hemispheres of the brain, the corpus callosum, was missing. So there's no communication between the right side of his brain and the left side of his brain. So the picture of this jar of pencils is firmly implanted in the right side of his brain, but the left side of his brain needed to do the quiz. And there was no communication from the left side to say, hey, pencils, go get one. So I realized somehow I needed to be able to share this information with teachers so that they understand. And so we're working closely. We do have him on an IEP now because we needed to provide extra support for him. So those are kinds of the things that we do. If you can think of a medical disease or diagnosis, chances are we've seen it at school. You know, we really have. It runs the gamut. And I know Ms. Drinkwater did a great job talking about the nursing-dependent children. I have two nursing-dependent children in my program, so I supervise, along with these children, I supervise two nurses that provide one-on-one care. They drive to the child's house in the morning, ride the bus with the child to school, and ride the bus with the child home. And so I'm responsible for also planning their care and providing for them also.
Are they part of the 12 nurses in your district?
No, they are not. Okay. They are not counted as part of my 12.
Okay.
So that, thank you, leads me into when we look at the numbers, and we have been, the Oregon School Nurse Association has been working really closely with ODE since we've started our reporting system. One of the things that we continue to do every year, we refine how we're gathering statistics. When they talk about the statistics of the numbers of nurses in schools, really, when you're looking at student-to-school-nurse ratio, you have to subtract out those nurses that provide one-on-one care because they can't provide care to other children in the school building ever. And so looking at the stats that we had, if you subtracted out those 150 nurses from the nursing-dependent students, it would drop us down to like 116 in the state. The Oregon School Nurses Association believes we're closer to 200 nurses providing nursing care to the whole student population, which bumps our ratio up closer to one nurse to every 4,000 students, which really is much more accurate for what we understand is the student-to-school nurse ratio for us here in Oregon. Mine is a pretty typical assignment for a large urban school district that has multiple nurses. So then your second question to me was, who's actually providing this care? And they introduced the Oregon delegation law allowed by the State Board of Nursing Practice. Every state differs. California has a much tighter delegation law. They don't allow a lot of things to be delegated that we do here in Oregon, so we have to kind of work within our scope within our state. So basically, what I'm allowed to delegate is a task of nursing to an unlicensed medical person. If we meet a whole bunch of criteria, you know, the State Board Division 47 is our delegation law. It is several pages long, and it is really very prescriptive on what I can do, what I can't do, and how I must do it, which allows us to do that kind of thing. The people that we delegate to, those are our support school staff. They are our school secretaries. They are our instructional assistants. I know you mentioned that you guys had just recently heard some information about diabetes. Diabetes care in Oregon, children, is skyrocketing. Type 1 diabetes. When I started 27 years ago, we had no children in our district with type 1 diabetes. We now have over 150. The other thing that has changed is the way in which we care for these kids. So we are now, with the invention of fast-acting insulin, we're now giving insulin at every meal and sometimes at every snack. So that can happen as many as two or three times a day. In our district, we have said we will not delegate the actual administration of insulin. In a hospital, it requires two nurses to give insulin. So I'm not going to ask my secretary to give insulin. And luckily, our district student support services support that. So our FTE actually has increased in the last year just simply to cover the number of diabetic students that we have. What also happens is
what you're implying, though, is that in the rules in your 45, in your delegation, you could delegate.
Yes, we can.
Okay.
And it is delegated across the state in many districts and in many areas. What it entails is I teach my secretary how to help a child poke their finger. They get a blood sugar number. They have to learn how to interpret that number. Do I give them a snack? Do I give them water? Do I have to give them a low blood sugar treatment? What does this number mean? Mealtime, they have to learn how to count carbohydrates because they need to calculate how many carbohydrates a child has eaten. They need to look at the ratio doctor's orders and say, because at one school I have two diabetics, one gets 1 unit of insulin for every 8 carbs that he eats, one gets 1 unit of insulin for every 40 carbs he eats. They also have to calculate in the blood sugar amount, because if their blood sugar is high, oftentimes we have to add insulin as a correction bolus. This is a huge process. This is a very medically intensive process that I'm asking a secretary to do, oftentimes at lunch, when there are millions of phone calls going on. Other kids are coming in for medications. It's recess for somebody. So you have children that have injured themselves at recess. It's an environment which invites disaster, honestly. And so I'm thankful that our district has allowed us to say we won't delegate administering insulin. That's only our district. Many, many do. However, in my district, as soon as a child is physically able to give their own shot, then I do delegate that to the secretary to manage all of that care for that child.
So what you're managing is keeping track of the medication, taking care of all that kind of stuff. The student is doing their own injection.
The student is doing their injection, but I'm asking school staff to manage everything else. The other thing that has caused great concern among almost all of my staff that I asked to delegate to, there's been a new seizure medication that was developed a few years ago. It's rectal diastat. It's a medication called diastat that's administered rectally. So what I have to do, and this is generally our instructional support personnel, our instructional assistants in our classrooms, so I train them to recognize the seizure, to time the seizure. When it reaches a certain magic minute that the doctor decides, they have to administer this rectal medication wherever the child is. So oftentimes, they have kind of response kits. So we'll have two people holding a blanket in a hall to try to provide privacy. I have my instructional assistant have to remove the child's pants and underpants, roll the student on their side, lift up their knees, separate their buttocks cheeks, and administer this medication. Now, to me, I can do that. That's not a big deal for me, but I'm a nurse. I'm imagining for anybody else in this room that isn't a nurse, that might be a pretty intimidating thing to do. The other thing, because of allegations of abuse in schools, this puts our staff at great risk because they're taught many, many times, don't be alone with a student, don't touch a student inappropriately, don't hug, I mean, touch from the side, you know, all those things. But yet now I'm asking them, nope, just pull down their pants, separate their little butt cheeks, and put this medicine in. It's very intimidating for staff to be able to do that.
And that could be a student at any age?
At any age, yes. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a student that is otherwise cognitively impaired.
Right.
You know, oftentimes it is, and these are students in our specialized programs, but it doesn't have to be. I have a girl that was just diagnosed with a seizure disorder last year, and her physician wanted her to have diastat at my high school, and she refused. She said, no, we're not going there. So that's kind of who we're asking to give medication, you know, that kind of thing. And that's just two brief examples of some of the medical procedures we're asking our school staff and our support staff to do. When you asked your question earlier about do all school districts have school nurses, no. ideally they have access to a school nurse. I just received an email the other day, kind of a congratulations email on the election, and it's from a school district that's very close to mine. And it's a school district that has a temporary nurse position that they fill every so often. This nurse actually had been there for 4 years, and she's leaving this year. And she said in her email, it's just breaking her heart because I know all the kids by face and by name. She said what she's asking my advice because the school district has asked her to print her health management plans, the special ed once for summer school. She said, I did take my name off of it and my license number and the review date, but I did give them my copies of my health management plans. She said, they also plan on continuing my nursing delegations throughout the summer, even though I will no longer be employed there as a school nurse. She said, I've been abused, totally disrespected. They have no appreciations for nurses in this district, which is concerning because that's against the state's, you know, the Nurse Practice Act. The school district can't do that, but yet it's happening over and over again. There's another district near us. They have 1,200 students, three schools in the district, very small. They contract with the ESD for 8 hours a week of school nursing time. They have five diabetics. So they ask the nurse to come work there 1 day a week. And then whatever happens to those kids the other 4 days a week, there's no nursing supervision, administration, consultation available other than this nurse saying, yeah, I give them my cell phone and they call me all the time. And I'm thinking, well, but that's not fair. You know, it is because it's protecting her license. And that's what she has to do. But school districts shouldn't be allowed to do that. You know, we are responsible for those plans that we write, but yet when we're not allowed to have the appropriate time to provide the appropriate care for those plans, that's when it really gets in trouble with our license. So I really appreciate your interest in this as the Education Committee. Like I said, School Nursing Association is working closely with the Department of Ed. We are encouraged by their desire to have another educational specialist. We had a state school nurse consultant at the Department of Education, and she retired, and they were unable to fill that with a nurse. We're hoping, and have talked to them a lot about, you really need to have a nurse at this level. We're hoping our legislation passes, which will also create a state school nurse consultant at the Oregon Health Authority, because those two individuals working together will be able to really support school nursing throughout the state. So if you have any other questions, I would be happy to answer.
So we talk about school nurses. Is mm-hmm. there a TSPC certification requirement for a school nurse as opposed to a regular nurse?
There is a TSPC certification requirement to be called a school nurse in the state of Oregon. However, districts may hire registered nurses and just not call them their school nurse. We do. I mean, we call all RNs working in the schools a school nurse. It's just a semantic thing with TSPC. And it gets into some contractual issues. In my school districts, it's required. There are a few districts across the state where it is required to work in the district. You have to be TSPC certified.
So is there a few other requirements they're going to put you through that a regular nurse would not have had?
No, that's the only one.
Just getting the license?
To be TSPC certified, yes.
All you have to have is be a nurse?
Yes, or all you have to do is have your nursing license, and you can walk into a school and they can hire you as your school nurse.
So the advantage you get by TSPC certification is the opportunity to spend the extra $150 for the license and to be called a school nurse?
Yes.
With no other requirements. That's interesting.
Yes.
I didn't realize that, so yeah. That's good for me to know.
The State Board of Nursing has recognized school nursing as a specialty practice of school nursing. I also have my national certification. That's the other fancy initials behind my name. It's Nationally Certified School Nurse, because I felt professionally that's what I needed to do. It's not recognized in the state of Oregon. It's not recognized, at least by the Department of Ed or school districts, as anything, you know, above and beyond. However, professionally, a lot of nurses in the state of Oregon believe that it is. And so that's one thing that we do to, you know, kind of maintain our practice standards. The other two fancy colored handouts that you have were supplied by the National Association of School Nurses, and this is average data. One is the number of health conditions per 100 students, and one is the home and community factors that impact learning per 100 students. And I think it's interesting to just visually see what it is that kids are bringing to school every day, and we're asking them to learn through many of these barriers, and our hope is that we're just able to be there to help reduce those barriers.
So does your district require, or is it required, for health records that come in for students to be observed by a nurse? So immunization records and all that kind of stuff. Who keeps track of that? Who do you?
The school secretaries keep track of immunization requirements. Some schools ask parents, and on our student information system, there are a few health questions. And if secretaries see that parents have written anything on those, they give them to us. So we do review them. There's not a specific policy or requirement around that. That's just what we've agreed to do with our secretaries.
So the student lists that they have an allergy on an intake.
Yes.
Do all of those go to a nurse to figure out what they have to do with that?
Ideally, yes.
Okay, just trying to check. I mean, I understand the policies of the high school I was at, and we valued nurses, so they did a lot of that stuff for us.
Yes.
In fact, it took an enormous amount of time at the beginning of the year for any one or two people to get through all of those records. So.
Yes, it does.
And then in fact, a requirement oftentimes to send out a note to all the teachers that have the child mm-hmm. if they have a particular condition.
That the teacher allergy. Needs to be aware of. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. In fact, one of your school nurses was School Nurse of the Year for 2014-15. Yeah. We were pretty excited about that.
Yep. Okay. Any other questions? I guess you get to bat last in this panel.
That's wonderful. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and member of the committee. I'm happy to be here. My name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association. And as you know, OSEA is a public and private sector union that represents predominantly classified, what we call classified school employees working in Head Start, K-12 districts, ESDs, and community colleges. They are everyone who is not a certified teacher, counselor, school nurse, or administrator. And they are the people to whom school nurses delegate the authority to provide medical services and procedures to students. And for that reason, I'm here today to, first of all, thank you for having this hearing. This is, in our opinion, a growing, an invisible crisis in our schools. That we have not dealt with sufficiently in Oregon because we're still operating under the old vision of schools, which is the healthy 9-year-old skipping into his or her classroom. That was what our schools were built to accommodate. And then the wonderful thing happened when the policymakers changed their minds and decided that children who are otherwise abled would be allowed the same rights to a public education as all other children. Our schools did not adapt to accommodate that change. We don't have medical personnel in the schools, as you have heard, and I agree with both of these people and the previous speakers on virtually everything they said. And because the kids need nursing services, that's delegated to the people that are there, the secretary or the educational assistant. I'm really, really sorry that I wasn't able to bring with me today some of our members who are actually performing these procedures so you could ask them directly what it's like for them when they are hired in a part-time, low-wage job and they are advocates for the disabled and they want to be there to teach these children when they may find half their day spent diapering students one after another. because that's the way it's set up, or they find themselves being required to, as you heard, administer emergency medication rectally to a student when, in some cases, they have had 10 minutes of conversation with a nurse as training. Our members really, really hope that the legislature recognizes that health care in schools is essential if we're ever going to provide the achieve the goal of 40-40-20, let alone provide humane and safe services to students. Our current system does not do that, and our members every day are frightened to death that they are going to mistakenly hurt a child. One of the things you should think about is when that happens, you will never know it. Federal laws protecting student and health privacy will prevent you from knowing that. We could be killing kids every day and you'd never know it. The only way to protect against that is to provide adequate staffing, well-trained adequate staffing by medical professionals to provide for these medical needs. Now, we think there's a simple solution to all of this. We could add another $2 billion to the state school fund and meet the quality education model funding level. The quality education model accounts for healthcare professionals in schools. So that's one way to do it, and that's my personal favorite. But if you can't meet that one, there's something you can do this session to move us forward. It's been mentioned by all the speakers so far, and that's passing Senate Bill 698. Senate Bill 698 establishes a position in the Oregon Health Authority that's required to work collaboratively with the school nurse position in the Department of Education to develop best practices and protocols that we can use in the districts and to provide real support to districts. It also establishes a task force whose main role is to figure out funding of health services in schools. Because the problem we have in schools is not that school districts don't want to provide health care, although they probably would prefer someone else do that. But the problem is they must spend state school fund dollars to do it, with some exceptions. And so when a school district with an ever decreasing school revenue stream has to choose between a teacher and a school nurse, they're often going to choose the teacher, because the secretary and the educational assistant are there for those services to roll downhill. Only at the state level can we solve these problems for districts and for my members. And Senate Bill 698 will move us in that direction. We are pleased to see the department asking the legislature for another position in the Department of Education to deal with school health services. And we are standing ready to help you in any way we can. Thank you.
Thank you. I do want to say one last thing. As a high school principal and a person that worked in the office where I was in charge of the nurse, who in my particular case ended up with a diagnosis of cancer and was not around a lot, and when she was there, it was really tough. So she trained me as an administrator to actually do some things. And I think one of the statements was made at the beginning was that if there is a medical issue out there, schools see it at some point. And in the 32 years, I am shocked at the opportunities I had, and I am fortunate to have had a number of those kinds of issues in my family, because we had one student who was wandering around school and everybody said he was drunk and they were just ignoring him, and I knew the student went and talked because that didn't seem right, and he smelled, his ketones were coming off pretty strong, and when I realized he's probably diabetic, that's why he's totally lost control, he doesn't know where he's at, what's going on. And low blood sugar is number one, the worst place. So getting him sugar, that was always the strangest deal to me, that whether it's up or down, give him sugar, because low can kill, high, yeah, he'll get over it. But that was a strange one, and it hurt that kid, because the opinion of a lot of people from that point on was that he'd been drunk on school grounds. And HIPAA doesn't allow you to talk to everybody about what's going on, so you take care of the problem, but that doesn't help that student and the assumptions that are made. In the last couple of years, the number of different kinds of things kept coming into the schools. So we had one young woman who was allergic to sunlight. Mm-hmm. And so we had to change every, we had to shield every light with a new, every one of these give off ultraviolet light. And so every place that she was in the building, and she had to wear cloth over her if she walked between buildings, it was amazing. And so you get to find out those things, whether it's those or different kinds of tumors. It was remarkable to me. As a teacher, I didn't notice it as much. As an administrator, it became overwhelming. And in the end, we had at least one person who was truly clinically diagnosed as multiple personality, and we had to make a plan to meet the person at the door and figure out who that person was today. Because you read, you hear, you look at stories, and it's hard for people to comprehend until you actually see and deal with those people. And so having a nurse was a security blanket for some of us. We realized this is really important for my mental health, because you wanted to have someone you could talk to who had enough information to help deal with whatever the situation that came up. And sometimes they just presented. I found out that if you blow your nose really hard at the wrong time, you can actually cause a seizure problem and cause a brain infection and do all sorts of other things. It made me change my idea about how I do this. I mean, it's unbelievable the kinds of things that can come in the form of a child just being a child, and all of a sudden there you are. So I appreciate what you do. I appreciate your information, and hopefully over the next little while we can start having a deeper conversation about how we help make sure that kids are as safe as they can be at school. I will tell you that one of the reasons we haven't done more is that people in your organization do a really good job.
They do.
Because they've been trained by people like you, and we haven't had the big problems. When the big problems happen, and we may have had some, like you said, generally when those really big problems happen, we find out about it, not because HIPAA doesn't allow us, because the parent sues us. I mean, the reality is when bad things happen, you are going to pay a price.
Yes.
And people care about their children. So we need to be, and we are supposed to be imparental, we are the parent when they're at school.
Right. Mr. Chair, the district may find, be held accountable through a lawsuit, but policymakers that are making choices about how to fund education and the services within it will never hear about
that.
And that's unfortunate. It's fortunate on an individual privacy level.
Right.
It's unfortunate on a public policy level because you can't see the true effect of today's system.
Yeah, and I'll finish on the last one because I have this young woman who lives still in my district, not in the same town. But I was talking to her one day, and she said, "Well, I'll always vote for you because I ate peanuts in a brownie that you made at school, and I had a peanut allergy and didn't realize till after I'd eaten it, and you were the only person that recognized it and got the emergency people there, and I'm still here today." So I really appreciate what happened. And, enough of those little things happen, you don't remember them internally. You just do what you have to do at the time. But the people who have it happen to them remember every one of these experiences at the school. Mm-hmm. And this new drug that you have to do, as a high school person, I can't imagine. Every student that I know that could would say it, not
absolutely
for me,
not.
because just having the seizure alone is really hard emotionally on those kids.
And yet we have high school students for whom my members must perform this procedure. And it's very scary when this is a student who may be 6 feet 4 inches tall and weigh 200 pounds and be in a life-threatening emergency. That's what's happening when you have to do this. He's having a seizure. And it's scary, it's difficult, and for an educational assistant to be required to do that is kind of crazy, in our opinion.
Okay. Yes,
thank you. I agree with everything you said, Tricia. And but even back in that world where 9-year-olds skip into a classroom healthy, I have one of those skippers, healthy kids. And twice this year, he got sick and went into the office and said, "I feel sick." And they said, "You're not sick. Get back into class." And, we're not parents that freak out and call lawyers and stuff. But, it was an eye-opener, that was made. A receptionist or a secretary made that medical diagnosis.
Exactly. All the time.
Yeah. And teachers do it, too. Our son, he was always very serious as a little kid. And didn't like to do that. And he kept saying, I really feel sick. Same thing. Yeah. And finally, he was standing at the door and tells me, I really feel sick. I should go. And nothing. And then he just all came. He had the flu. It all came. The teacher said, I will expect that next time because you know, didn't stand out of the way. So she understood quickly that he was sick. But it's, you know, I agree. I mean, it's.
Well, parents train their kids, okay, if you feel bad, tell an adult you feel sick, and then, you know, the thing will be taken care of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When I was a little kid, I broke my arm often in school. And every time I did, walk into the school nurse. We were personal friends because I was in there so often. My parents didn't have to worry whether or not someone who was trained as a medical professional was going to take care of me and my many mishaps. Parents today don't. They think that their children are protected. They think that the schools will take good care of them and that medical professionals will be doing these things. But it's not the case.
Can I ask where 698 is?
It's in the Ways and Means Human Services sub.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you. We have one last panel, Laura Conroy and Steve Moore.
I hate to abandon.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you. Hello. You get me left, but that's okay. This is on the record, and it'll be part of our stuff that we work on as we go in the interim.
All right. Well, Mr. Chair, I'm Steve Moore. I thank you for giving me the opportunity to participate in this informal meeting. I'm a school health services supervisor for the Multnomah Education Service District. And full disclosure, I'm also the president-elect of the Oregon School Nurse Association. At the MESD, we employ roughly half the school nurses working in the state of Oregon. We serve roughly 100,000 students in Multnomah and Clackamas County, and we work with our component districts to develop and implement school nursing services as their resources allow. This means that we do not have a standard model of nursing service delivery. We really work with them to see how much they can afford, and then we try to put together nursing services for them that will at least meet the minimum requirements that they need to support their students in school. So just with that being said, I just wanted to point out there's tremendous variability across the state on what nursing services look like and how they're delivered. If a district has a lot of resources, they can hire a school nurse to the level of that 1 to 750 that is the ideal number from the National Association of School Nurses. And when you have somebody in a role like that, I come from public health, and so we talk about primary, secondary, and tertiary prevention. Primary prevention is really education and trying to keep kids from becoming sick. Secondary is you're screening kids and seeing do you have a problem and what can we do to keep them from developing a worse problem or maybe mitigate that problem, say, with vision screening so that they can be successful in school. And the tertiary part is actually the kid fell down and they're scraped up and they need some help, so clinical services. So if you're in a district that has a lot of resources, you can hire a nurse that's going to be able to provide all of those services and do some pretty creative stuff. If you're a district that doesn't have that level of resources, we're really focusing on our nurses are really focusing on someone's not breathing or they're bleeding to death. We're definitely going to respond to that. If there's a communicable disease outbreak in the school setting, we're going to coordinate closely with the local health department to make sure that, you know, we put the controls in place to keep other people from getting sick. And then really the lion's share of time beyond that is doing care coordination and case management. So these are kids that we know are ill, or they're newly diagnosed, or they newly come into that school setting. And then we're working with the student, their family, their medical providers, school administration, to follow the nursing process, which is assessment, planning, implementation, and evaluation of what you're going to do. So that's how we're prioritizing, and that's how the majority of nurses I supervise at the MESD are operating right now. And so most of the nurses, I supervise nurses in the East County of Multnomah County, where it's a little less resource heavy than the west side where Portland is. And so we have a ratio of about 1 to 3,000 nurses in that in the school districts, and we're really focusing on that case management piece. And that involves, so we identify the problem, we get the doctor's orders, we've talked to the family. Next thing we need to do is talk to the building administrator and say, hey, we need some staff that can actually provide care to the student when we're not here. And so that's a bit of a coordination. Some administrators are better at providing staff to do that than others. Sometimes there has to be higher level discussions in order to get that staff to us. And that's problematic because the Nurse Practice Act Division 47 that you heard about earlier that talks about delegation says that whoever you're delegating to has to, one, say that they're willing and able to do the task, and two, they have to be able to demonstrate that they can do the task. So our nurses are under tremendous pressure to make things work with the resources that they're given, even though that person may not be the ideal person. So our Nurse Practice Act says we identify the person, we train the person up. If they can demonstrate and show competency and verbalize competency, then we can go ahead and allow them to do that delegated care. The nurse needs to do an evaluation by the Nurse Practice Act once within the first 60 days and then every 180 days thereafter. Of course, if there's concerns from our nurses, they're on top of it much more frequently than that, and they're having conversations with their administrators and oftentimes with me to help negotiate what we can do to make sure that we have reasonable people in place to support the students in school. And so a typical scenario would be one of a diabetic student where we have done all those interviewing and working with the family and the doctor and getting the orders. And then it would be the process of delegation. And so for a student with diabetes, insulin-dependent diabetes, that would be training. And really the recommendation is that we train three people for each student who has one of these chronic health conditions because of absenteeism of the staff, because we have tremendous staff turnover with, as was pointed out earlier, kind of lower paying jobs. And so staff is leaving quite a bit. Gaps open up in the education system where they need to pull this EA to go work in this other class or this other school. And so we try to identify and train up three people who can at least work with this student once a week to keep their skills current. And so for the diabetic student, that would be training them to take a blood sugar with a glucometer, training them to count carbohydrates so they can calculate the appropriate amount of insulin based on that, training them to draw up and administer insulin, which, as Nina had pointed out earlier, in a hospital setting, that requires two nurses to make sure that you have the correct dose before you actually give that injection. Training them how to respond to a medical emergency if they do have an extremely low blood sugar and pass out. In your situation, it sounded like you were fortunate enough that the student was still able to take something by mouth. But if that student is not at that place, then they have to actually receive an injection. So we're training that staff to give injection. And then we're doing that with all three of those staff, and we're watching those staff on a fairly regular basis. And we're retraining new staff all the time because of that turnover that I was talking about earlier. And so oftentimes this creates a lot of anxiety in the parents of these students who were serving. And I will say in one particular case that stands out to me about a diabetic student that came to a school, it's a district with over 3,000 students who they have one nurse. The parents did the right thing. They were new into the school district. They had a kindergartner. Mom was an emergency room nurse. Dad was a school administrator in another state. They went to the school. They had a well-prepared presentation and packet on all about their student and what they needed to do and how they could work with them. The student was in school for a couple of weeks before the nurse was notified that they were there. And unfortunately, a lot of the things that the parents were directing the school staff to do, which they were doing quite well, actually, weren't legal under the Nurse Practice Act. Actually, the student needed to be managed by a nurse. All of these doctor's orders, these plans, the delegations, according to our state Nursing Practice Act, that all should have happened under the guidance of the nurse. And so sitting in that 504 meeting, trying to explain this to these parents who were very angry and frustrated by the fact that nobody had told them until just right now, showed me the disconnect between what a lot of school administrators understand to be what they need to provide in order to keep these students safe at school, and what the actual ODE as well as nursing laws would require that happens. And that's where I think, going back to the Senate Bill 698, it's so important to have some kind of leadership at the state level that can actually look at policy and procedure development, look at coordinating better between the Oregon Health Authority and the Oregon Department of Education, working with the State Board of Nursing around delegation to clarify. These delegation rules were really written with this idea in the 80s that we were going to experience this tremendous nursing shortage and no one was going to be able to take care of these folks, so we needed to make sure we could delegate to other people to do this. And it was meant for, say, adult foster care homes and some of the smaller settings in which oftentimes you might have somebody with some level of training, and somehow it got expanded into being in schools where we're in these situations where we have the statewide average of one nurse to 4,000 students. And I know you've heard different numbers throughout the day. This kind of ties into what Nina was saying, that some of those calculations include one-to-one nurses and other folks. So that's where we're at now, and it's really my hope, if we can better coordinate how we're delivering care, and we can have this task force look at all the various health service partners as well as different systems of payment and come up with a better way of doing business, our students' health and education outcomes are going to do nothing but improve.
Thank you. You're just here to be there.
Okay. She's my moral support.
So it sounds like ESD in Multnomah County is providing most of the nursing care for the school districts?
Correct.
They're basically contracting you for the nursing services?
Correct.
So many of them have no nurse of their own?
Correct.
In school? Wow. Okay. That's amazing.
Right. So we work with our administration, works with the district administration, and then they ferret out how many nurses they can afford, and then we start looking at, okay, how can we divvy up this assignment to make it manageable given the resources we have, and what are the things that we really need to focus on giving the level of resources that they're providing us. And this causes some confusion and, frankly, some pushback from individual schools at time, in that district-wide decisions get made that don't appear to filter down quite to the level where maybe they should be. And so where, you know, a lot of people say if it's bleeding, if there's vomit or feces, or that's a nurse's job to do, our nurses aren't oftentimes there at the school to do it. And when they are at the school, oftentimes they're working on developing these plans and training the staff so they can manage these kids with chronic health conditions. And so that puts us sometimes in an awkward situation where we're having to defend to the school staff why it is we're doing what we're doing, because to the untrained eye, we have somebody there just doing paperwork all day when they really should be in the health room giving kids Band-Aids and ice packs. So Laura wanted me to point out that we do provide other programs as well. We have programs such as YogaCom, where we work with, some of our nurses provide this, where we have nurses that are trained in this technique of self-calming, and they'll work with the school staff around identifying kids that are challenged with being able to regulate their behavior, and they'll learn techniques for doing this. And I've heard some really great stories about the after effects of kids who've gone through this training and being on the playground exhibiting some weird breathing behavior and people being really concerned, only to find out that that's something that they learned through taking their YogaCom class. We work a lot with issues of mental health, where we're, you know, a trusted person in that building that oftentimes students come to first for, sharing with us their story and asking us to try to help them find resources to get the need that they are, their needs met, wherever we can help them in the community.
So it would, this is just off the top, I just want to say it's harder because you will assign your nurses to a particular building, so they don't have to change every day. I mean, I understand that, but and the kids and the school start to see them as their school nurse
right.
for whatever portion of time. But at the same time, they aren't hired by the district. They're hired by you, which creates tension between them and the rest of the people at different times, especially if they can't do all the things that the school wants them to do.
Right. And when we talk about our one-to-one student population, it's unfortunately, it's ripe with triangulation around who's responsible for doing what, and that's often an uncomfortable place to be as well.
Yeah, that's true. Okay. I will ask myself if I have any more questions. I don't, so I think I'm okay there. I do appreciate you coming. We may, as time goes on, if we decide that we need a work group to start having conversations during the interim, I will get a hold of people who have volunteered to be part of that, along with others. I haven't exactly decided what we're going to do and how much time I have to do that, but I anticipate by next session we need to have more conversations, at least to develop an understanding of where we really are, because I don't think most people do have any clue. So with that, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
And with that, we're going to close our informational meeting on student medical emergencies and treatment at schools. And with that, there's no other deals. And just so people know, the few that are watching and if anybody's listening, this is the last scheduled meeting of this committee in which we can do work sessions. So work sessions are over. We will be having a meeting next Tuesday with regard to work group that we're going to be having during the interim on the OEIB. So with that, we will adjourn the Senate committee. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. We will adjourn the Senate committee. Thank you.